Good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started.
Good fit.
I'm Jim Bishop. I'm the chair of the board of directors of the Training and Orientation Committee, and we'll be chairing this special call board orientation training meeting. Today is March 26, 2026. The time is 11:03 a.m. Central Standard Time. I now call order to this special meeting of the board of directors of the Surplus Line Stamping Office of Texas. The meeting is being held in person at the Surplus Line Stamping Office, too many S's, of Texas, 1601 East Pflugerville Parkway, Suite 3301, Pflugerville, Texas, 78660. Written notice of this meeting, the proposed agenda, and all related meeting materials were provided to the Texas Department of Insurance, Deputy Commissioner of the Financial Regulation Division, and her designees on March 16, 2026. In accordance with the Surplus Line Stamping Office of Texas. Plan of Operations, Section 2, C, Number 2, written notice of this meeting and the related agenda were submitted to the Office of the Secretary of State and published on March 19, 2026 in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. All board members were notified of this meeting on March 4, 2026. The conference call-in number was provided to members of the public in the public meeting notice. I will now call roll, which board members are participating in today's meeting. And actually, rather than split it out like we've done in the past, I'm going to start with Greg. We're going to go around the room, introduce yourself, who you're with, and then we'll continue, I think, Denise, with those that are online. Greg?
Sure. Hi, everybody. I'm Greg Brandon. I'm the Executive Director of the Stamping Office.
I'm Ronnie Ford. I'm the Director of Finance of the Stamping Office.
I'm Jeff Klein. I'm of counsel with the law firm of McIntyre & Lemon in Charlotte.
Hi, I'm Marissa Gomez. I am with SLTX as the administrative assistant.
I'm Jim Bishop. I'm executive vice president of Bridge Specialty Group in Dallas.
I'm Leah Bennett. I am the director of property casualty for Copeland Insurance and Integrity Marketing Group.
I'm Jody Delgado. I'm the director of agent industrial licensing with the Texas Bar of Insurance.
Evening, government relations at TDM.
Yeah, I'm an associate commissioner and chief analyst of the financial analysis.
David Dodd, an attorney with the Office of Financial Counsel for you.
Stephanie Caparelli with company licensing and registration with you.
Jeff McCord, Mitchell Williams, serve as a general counsel for SLTX.
Leslie Lilgenberg, and I'm a Lilgenberg expert witness.
I'm Toby Pick, and I'm director of policy intake and analysis at SLTX.
Denise Mesquita, Director of HR, SLTX.
And I'm Shawanda Stone, Director of IT, SLTX.
And over the phone, we have Pete Harrison. He is, well, Pete can introduce himself.
Yeah.
He's muted.
You're muted, Pete.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
Pete Harrison, active for Dallas.
And then we have Ruben Olivares from SLTX, he's a policy analyst, and Sharmila Suedi, she is SLTX UA. That's all we have.
All right. Before we get started, a few reminders. Antitrust activity or discussion are prohibited at all stamping office functions. This prohibition includes the exchange of information concerning individual company rates, coverages, market practices, claim settlement practices, expenses, or any other competitive aspect of an individual company's operation. We will not have a public comment session. Public and media attendee listening by telephone should mute their lines at all times. Representatives of the state agencies and members of the public are welcome to observe or record this board meeting, but please refrain from asking questions or interjecting comments during the board's deliberations. State agency personnel present may be asked questions about their agency's policies if those questions relate to an agenda item. Members, counsel, and staff should identify themselves by full name when speaking. Please mute your microphone or telephone when not speaking. Next on our agenda, we have we don't have any new board members to introduce. So, all right, I'm going to turn it over to Greg.
All right, thanks, everybody. Super excited for this orientation today, simply because we have TDI here. So this kind of originated, I think, before my time here 6 years ago. I think maybe it was more the norm for TDI to participate in board orientations. Somehow or another, we got away from that. But to be honest with you, I never even thought to ask until I went to a SILA meeting last October. I was just trying to be cool at a table with Jody. And I thought, I'm just going to go and introduce myself. I don't know Jody at all. And then at this table was the entire world wanting to ask Jody questions. And Jody rapid-fired answers left and right like an hour. And I'm like, I learned more just sitting here listening than I ever knew about TDI. And then so it occurred to me, this would be very beneficial. The board represents TDI. It would be very beneficial for our board members to have the same interactions and kind of get a glimpse of what TDI does. We've been kind of off TDI's radar by choice for a long time. But as I sat there in awe of Jody and her amazing abilities, so it turned into me asking at the last quarterly session, saying, could we maybe have someone from TDI give us an orientation about your organization? We split it up. It's a little bit different, right, than a normal orientation, because we made it so that if TDI needs to leave, they can. So you guys have the hour. You can take as much time as you need. Quite frankly, we've got all of this scheduled until like 3 o'clock. We do have lunch coming. We can certainly take a break for lunch if you want to work through lunch. It kind of depends on how all of this goes. So we will freeform it. And so when TDI finishes up with their orientation, we'll grab lunch and then we'll come back and do ours, probably starting around 1 o'clock. And then Pete, you're probably free to go. I know you've got some meetings you've got to go to. So you've sat through our orientation for the better part of 10 years. So probably skip out after that. But
let's change.
So I will turn it over to the folks from TDI and I look forward to hearing from you. So thanks for being here.
Bear with me. I don't represent any teams.
If this works.
Denise Love over there.
Oh, it's okay. There you go. We have multiple screens, so then I just share the screen that I want to share. So, okay, we're gonna figure this out. So, my name is Jody Delgado. I am the director of Asian Adjuster Licensing, and that is inside the Consumer Protection Division. That's probably a division that y'all may not have had a lot of exposure to, because I think y'all are most closely working with FRD a lot. So. Just a little bit about our division. It makes up three departments. The first is mine, Agent Adjuster Licensing, responsible for regulating all the licensing insurance professionals. So agents, adjusters, insurance agencies. We also have escrow officers thrown in there, and then continuing education providers. Second division is the complaint and dispute resolution. That's responsible for handling insurance complaints. And I like to really think of it as they're responsible for protecting consumers. We're really the first ears on the ground if there's any kind of problems or trends that might be happening with an insurance company or policies or, you know, whatever we might see out there. We're a lot of times the first people that hear about it. It also includes the independent dispute resolution system that handles arbitration and mediation for out-of-network claims disputes between medical providers and health plans. And then another part of that division is the contact center and services. They really just support those two divisions. So we have a contact center dedicated to agent adjuster licensing, and we have a contact center dedicated to complaints resolution. And then we have kind of our tech team that handles all of our data analysis, all of our my printer's not working. So they help us out there.
Jody, the contact center is like a call center?
It is a call center. So we also have email. Email is not used as much with complaints, but with the licensing fund, we probably get 500 to 600 emails a day. On that team where they're answering emails, and we'll get into some of the hold times and stuff like that, because we've made some really great strides on that. But really just an entire I like the way it's divided up, because it really is an entire section that's dedicated to supporting these major divisions that are inside the agency, and but being the go-between between the agency and the folks outside of it. So either, you know, how whatever our customers are, whether that be consumers or the licensees out there, the licensees need help. So starting with agent adjuster licensing, I put some quick numbers over there. We have over 1 million active licenses. That makes that are active right now in the state. That makes up about 870,000 individuals and firms. So there are people that are double licensed, surplus license agents, for example, have that underlying PNC. So they get counted twice in that license count. Last year, we received over 193,000 applications. We process those on an average of one business day. So we'll get into that a little bit here in a second. And then over 40,000 license change requests happen. So people change their name, they change their address, they change their state of residency. We processed over 40,000 of those last year. And we accomplished that through three teams inside what's called, I'm just going to start calling it AAL. So now that I've let y'all know the acronym. First is the application team. They really handle the front end license application processing. Then we have the administrative review team that handles what we call non-standard apps. And then that third team handles anything that's not an app. So anything for current licensees. So they do continuing education and what we call license maintenance. Move, it did not move. Okay. Can't use my keyboard. Mind that. So digging deeper into the application team itself, before an application even reaches TDI, we utilize a contract with our examination vendor to review applications on the front end for completeness. So most applications are going to need something, an exam, for example. You need a passing exam at the time of your application. If they don't have that, that front end vendor kicks it back and we don't even see it until it has kind of those basic needs. So we want to make sure, is there a mismatch on your SSN? Did you mistype your date of birth? Do you have your underlying examination? Are you 18 years old? Once all those kind of initial qualifications get met, then it gets sent to our applications team at TDI. And we process it through what we call like completion. And a lot of that for that application team means reviewing the criminal history. So we have a contract with FBI and the DPS to be able to review people's backgrounds. And we are able to actually access their secure site system to see a background. Now, a big thing about that is people often think, oh, it's been 7 years. I didn't think I had to tell y'all about it. Or It's actually not a conviction. I don't have to tell you about you. You have to tell us about everything. And if it ever happened to you, it's going to be on that background. So we do look and we pay really close attention to that. And we review that criminal history. So when that initial team reviews that criminal history and the app itself, they're going to make a licensing decision really right then. If there's no problems with the app and they've met the initial qualifications, we can approve that application pretty quickly. If there's some other deficiency we need to clear up, they'll send that deficiency notice. But let's say there's some kind of background problem, then it's going to get referred to our administrative review team for a deeper review. And about 10% of our applications get referred to that team each year. The administrative review team, and they handle what we call non-standard licensing apps. So they're referred to us for some kind of background issue, could be criminal history. Could be you have a CE or continuing education problem from a license you previously held with us. We remember those things, so we need you to clear that up. Could be what we call a Ryers action. So they have some kind of regulatory issue with another DOI because we talked to the other state's DOIs. We work very closely with them. So if you had a problem in Florida, we know about it, and you're going to need to clear that up with us and make sure we understand what happened and make sure that we are still qualifying you for licensure. So the way they do that is they start off with requesting additional information from the applicant. And we do all of this, and the things that we ask for are all in accordance with the TAC 1.502, which is really rooted in Chapter 53 of the Occupations Code. And that's asking for things like your work history, letters of recommendation, any other evidence of rehab. If you're saying that all of your crimes were rooted in your drug addiction, do you have evidence that you're no longer addicted to drugs, you know, so things like that. We're going to look pretty deeply at what your situation is. No two applicants the same. We don't have any crime that's an automatic disqualifier, but instead we look at every single individual person that may have some kind of background issue, and we're going to take the seriousness of the crime, and then we're going to see if that is outweighed or if the rehab evidence outweighs to make a licensing decision. So the admin review team is either going to approve or deny the app in accordance with the administrative code. But let's say once you're licensed with us, things happen. Most licensees are required to complete 24 hours of continuing education, three of those being in ethics, and that CE team is responsible for ensuring that. There are ways to do CE or be CE compliant without doing the 24 hours through a pre-CE course with TDI. And a lot of that is qualifying credit. So there are specific examples where you can use your credit in other organizations to apply to your CE transcript at TDI. A big one's the state bar. So if you happen to also be an attorney, you don't need to take both of our CEs. Take the state bar attorney CE and then tell us about it. Another one is if you are in pursuit of a national designation, you can tell us about the courses you took and receive self-study credit for those courses. Another big deal that we deal with in CE is the exemption. So we have an exemption. It's actually pretty unique to Texas. I'm not aware of other states. Maybe one or two other states have it. But if you are continuously licensed in Texas for 20 years with no gaps, and you've been CE compliant that whole time or corrected your non-compliance, you can request a permanent exemption from your CE so you no longer have to do it. So that ends up being a lot of the requests we get, because as you can imagine, people don't like doing CE very often. So once they hit their 20,
I'm there. Woohoo!
There you go. There's always someone in the
real estate like department. Real estate department used to do that too. Frank used to do that. Took it away.
Yeah, so that is kind of, there are states that frown upon that Texas even has this, just because we rely reciprocally on so many states to make sure, like when you have a home state, we are, if you're from New Mexico, we are making, New Mexico is vouching for this non-resident here, and that they're supposed to have substantially similar requirements. So sometimes they get a little upset that they, when they learn that a Texas resident hasn't been doing CE for a decade.
Don't go to Florida.
Right. Yes. So they will get you. So there are some states that learn about that and then make you, if you're from Texas, provide proof of your CE. So
you say 20 consecutive years. So if you move out of state, move back.
Or... 20 continuous years. So yeah. So it's a little different. And you can't, if you move out of state and you move back, but you maintain non-resident licensure with us, then your time counts. But if you moved out of state, you didn't have a license with us, you start over.
I'm there.
All right, there you go. Send in a request. There you go. What was that in a day, too? Review your application later. Yeah. The other big thing we deal with are CE auto fines. So there is a fine for not completing CE. Not only is your license not going to be allowed to renew if you don't have CE on file, you get fined $50 per credit hour, up to $500 per license. So it hurts, and you got to pay that before your license renews. So, that also a lot of our time.
Do you allow remote testing, or does it have to be in person? I don't know. That's a big issue with the NEIC.
So remote testing for new licenses, we don't have remote testing. We had it during COVID, and that has been removed. But we have hundreds of test sites. If you compare our Texas to other states, I think we have like 800 testing locations throughout the state, where when you're a state, like I think the one that still has kept remote testing was like Virginia. They have like 40 test sites throughout their state. So we have a robust availability of testing. So the need for remote testing isn't there in Texas, even in the, you know, we have locations, and we allow testing on military bases too. So I think that's a big help as well. CE team also regulates the CE providers. We have about 1,000 registered CE providers that give over 12,000 certified courses with us. Those courses get re-reviewed every 2 years and recertified. So just to make sure the information's good and up to date, and make sure ultimately the goal is that we have an educated workforce, and we want to make sure the courses that they're taking that we're requiring them to take are actually going to be helpful and informative for them. So that's kind of a little peek at CE. It gets way big. I guess I didn't talk about extensions. There are some things that happen. Life happens, right? You know, you might have a death in the family. You yourself might get injured or sick, or something happens where you can't complete your CE on time. The administrative code does allow us to grant extensions that will either, you know, completely take away the CE requirement for that term, or grant you an extended period of time to complete the CE late without having to do a fine. So there are specific circumstances laid out in the code, you know, death in the family, major illness, major injury, you're taking care of somebody that may be experiencing something severe, anything that's not what we're going to call business related or financial. It can't be my job didn't sign me up for CE. That's not going to be granted. But if you have a reason approvable by the code, we also grant extensions so you don't have to pay that fine. Your license isn't going to renew until your CE is good, but at least you're not going to have that fine to add on top of it. So just some numbers here. So y'all may have heard that Texas ranks number 2 in the nation in terms of the insurance market, and that translates over to licensing. And you could really see that in the growth just in the last 10 years. So we have the number of licenses issued in blue and renewed in red, and you really just can see steady growth. And even maybe the last few years, we've kind of leveled out on new licenses approved each year, but you can see the renewal still keeps growing. So we're not an industry where people are just one and doneing it. They're not just getting that license and leaving. That certainly happens, but more and more people are coming into the industry as agents and adjusters and staying in there, which I find fascinating. Just less than fiscal year. Let me get the next slide. If you look at fiscal year 2021 for the number of licenses, was at 780,000. By now today, we ended fiscal year 2025 at 983,000. 6 months into fiscal year 2026, we're over 1 million. So we just keep growing. I started in the end of 2018. And I remember it was like an amazing big deal when we crossed over 700,000. So it's just in that small amount of time that we've, you know, won almost a 50% growth. Like, so just keeps growing. There's still room for agents in Texas. And then just number wise, if you think about, there are about right at 10,000 surplus line agents in Texas, 8,000 of those being individual and about 2,000 being insurance agencies. And we get about 1,500 surplus line applications. So how do we handle that growth in my division while being hopefully efficient? We really focused on modernization these last several years. You can kind of see where we were and where we got to. The big indicator was we went away from paper. So 99% of our processing, anything you need, is handled and submitted electronically to us. Even if that is a form you fill out, you submit it electronically to us. We're not getting stuff in the mail. Every now and then we do. We're not getting paper renewal payments like we used to. Everything's done online, and that has really, really helped us increase efficiencies across the board. So not in the not so distant past, we were taking over 30 days to process a license application or renewal. We're doing that within one business day now. And that one business day is for standard applications. If it's not those non-standard apps, we're still talking to you within one business day to tell you what we need. And now at that point, we're waiting on you. So we're still letting you know quickly what we might need from you for license application processing. And then getting faster at processing licenses and renewals means generally we get less phone calls. So now we're able to have 98% call capture rate, where we were answering less than 50% of our calls back in the day. And now our hold time's right at a minute when it was at 32 minutes. Me personally, I was an agent. 2014 is when I got my license. And I remember my old boss used to make me call about twice a week, call TDI to check on the status of my license application. And I would just call them and I'd put them on hold and I'd go back to doing my like administrative work until they answered, and it would be a long time. So happy to just really be available for licensees, because if a lot of times, especially if you're calling, you're wanting to do it right, you're just looking for help and assistance. So being able to get them that answer just makes everybody more efficient. So just to touch on surplus line agent requirements, I'm not sure how much y'all know, so this could all be same information for y'all, but you need an underlying license. A lot of times that's going to be that general lines, property and casualty, but it can be that managing general agent. And the way to get that license, you take and pass. You do need to pass. You can't take the exam. Pass the exam. And then maintaining that license is that underlying continuing education from your underlying license. The surplus license itself doesn't have additional requirements, but you're not going to be able to keep that surplus lines license if you're not keeping that underlying PNC license. And the renewals, I'm really proud of the renewals because I feel like we've gotten better at this. They used to have different renewal expiration dates for your different licenses. They used to be the anniversary of your license, but now all of your licenses have moved to the last day of your birth month every other year. So just around your birthday, see if that's the year that you need to renew or not.
That cuts down on compliance problems and having to report to other states. And
sure, for sure. And it just is easier to manage if you're an individual. Again, I remember when I was an agent, mine was like a random the 14th of the month and whatever year. And it's just like, it's so much easier to have it aligned. And when you're a multi-state license, all other states do it this way too. So we've worked really hard with other states. So your expiration date is the same across the board. It's very helpful. Makes it easier. There's less excuses not to do what you need to do because we make it so easy for you. And then a requirement really of all people or, you know, entities that we regulate is you need to timely report any changes to us. And that's good or bad. So you could have got married and that's awesome. You need to tell us about your name change. If you're running around, presenting yourself under a different name as an agent, we need to make sure we know about it. Or the bad stuff. If you got arrested, or got a conviction, we need to know about that. If you got in trouble with another state, you need to tell us about it before that other state does. It's timely report. That's monthly. So every 30 days. If you move, you need to tell us about it. Just, you know, anything that changes, make sure you're aware. And I always plug this anytime I'm giving any kind of talks. We've got a CIRCON page for any agents. So if you have anybody that they'll know that we can direct this to you. This is really where we're wanting people to go because it's just such an easy way to timely report those changes. You can do your name update request, your address update request. You can manage your license, renew your license, look at your CE transcript, all sorts of fun, apply for a new license. Really is the start of everything for license regulation from the individual level, how to keep up with what they're doing. And you can see your other state's licenses too if you're dual state licensed. So the other division, which I am not as knowledgeable on because I am not running that program, but is the complaint resolution program. And they're, like I touched on, they're responsible for resolving the consumer complaints about all lines of insurance. The big one we get is auto and homeowners. It's PNC based. I did look up some numbers. We did have 286 complaints regarding surplus lines last fiscal year. Overall, we resolved over 19,000 complaints last year. Our average processing time is 69 days from start of complaint to close of complaint. And we'll get into, you know, where that number goes because that sounds high and it is high. We want to be at 40, but there are some built-in dates that kind of prevent us from getting any quicker than that. I will say at the end of fiscal year 25, we were at 92 days. So just in the last 6 months of fiscal year, this first 6 months of this fiscal year, we've gained 30 days processing. And hopefully in this last, we'll end strong and gain that 30 and get back to where we want to be with that 40 days. We've returned over 89.6 million payments and premiums returned to consumers. And the way we do that, so this is just the overall process. So we get a complaint that goes through our portal and the analyst is going to review that complaint and ultimately write a letter to the respondent. A lot of times that's going to be a company, an insurance company, but it could be an agent, could be an adjuster. It could be an insurance agency, but we're going to write out a letter to the respondent and say, hey, this is the complaint we got. Here's a copy of it. Here's some supporting documentation. What happened? What's going on? What's the deal? They have initially 15 days to respond to us, so they could take the full 15 days, and then they can even request an extension of 10 days. So built into our timeline is 25 days that we could just be waiting on a response from somebody. So it's hard to get faster than that if we're having to wait on, and they have they have that statutorily available to them to take that long. So, and a lot of times they do. So once we get a response back, we will review and, you know, review all the documents, and we are going to send out a resolution or a complaint closing letter to the respondent, or we may escalate it if that kind of what I touched on, like, oh my gosh, this might be a trend, or this is the 10th version of this complaint that we've gotten this month. That's when we want to look at it for an escalation of maybe other people need to have their eyes on this. But a lot of times reaching out to the company itself is going to resolve it and encourage that communication between the company and the insured. So hopefully it gets resolved and we're able to close that complaint. And like I said, we try to do that within 40 days of receipt. That's really our goal when we think about 25 of those days waiting on a response from somebody. So just some best practices, if you or someone you know are ever the subject of a complaint, it doesn't necessarily mean you're in trouble. This is another thing we always talk about. But the big deal is respond to it. You are required to respond to it. If you are regulated by TDI, you know, answer the issue. Sometimes we have some struggles with respondents that may be not directly answering the question at hand. You know, be thorough, be detailed, and, you know, proactively reach out with any questions. Because ultimately, we're just trying to find the resolution of, you know, it could be an instance where the consumer is totally misunderstanding what's happening, you know, and so we're there to educate them, but we need the information from the company to do that. So details are helpful, and we just want to be there to, you know, help both sides there.
You have to report the number of complaints to the state legislature.
I believe we do. Yeah, I'm sure we do. We have some LBB measures. I don't know them or see them, but we report monthly the complaints opened and closed and how long it takes us to do that. So we have that average closing time. That's a measure that we try to meet where our goal is 40 days. So that's all I got on the Consumer Protection Division. So any questions or comments, concerns?
I don't mean to talk too much, but I was just wondering, I was on the Hill a couple of weeks ago with WSIA, the surplus lines trade, and we're trying to get NARAB adopted. That's a federal compact that would allow you to get a non-resident license, and it was adopted, I don't know, pre-Obama, and neither Obama or Trump has ever appointed a board. So I just wanted you to know the industry is trying to push that again.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
So it would be helpful.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like we work really well with non-resident states. You know, if you have a resident license in any, there's not a state that we're not reciprocal. So as long as the license aligns. Now, if you have what we call like you're licensed only in Oklahoma to sell credit insurance, we're not giving you what I call the big boy license, the General Lines Property and Casualty. But if you're lined up with that same authority and the keywords are, you know, substantially similar requirements and substantially similar requirements to renew and keep that license, then they line up and we'll grant that non-res, provided that you haven't committed some crime that we tend to care about more than maybe Oklahoma or something like that, if that happens to happen. And then all agents have what we call a national producer number that you use across the states too.
But I will say your customer service is very good. And I moved out of state and came back, and if I call, they'll answer the phone, and other states are not that good.
Well, that's awesome to hear.
Yeah, seriously, it's very comforting because, I mean, it's like, you know, it's a reciprocal state, but I'm like, there's a period when I'm like, my license or I'm not licensed.
For sure.
I'm taking the darn test again.
Right. Totally. That's great feedback.
I want to say the educational requirement and submitting educational is easier since when I first got licensed in 2017 versus now.
Self. Yes. Yeah, it's easier on my staff too. I'll say that. Like having it uploaded by the provider and then it's automatically on your profile, that's less manual process on our end. That way your license gets renewed quicker and it's everybody. In for everybody.
What happened if Greg Brandon wanted to file a complaint against one of us on the board?
That's what I just laid out. Respond timely.
Number's probably not intended for complaints for board.
No.
Yeah.
We'll have discussions first. I am fascinated, though. 286 complaints. Some of those come to us, but I didn't have any ideas anywhere near 286. Maybe it's not a surprising number to you, but that's like one every other day.
Like, you notice how many licenses, 983,000 licenses. So that's the minimal little number.
Compared. No, you're right. Yeah. Well, of the, well, let's call it 10,000 surplus lines licenses, even that statistically is a pretty good
percentage.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
And I didn't check if they were confirmed or unconfirmed, so they could just be a... You know, there's a difference between the person didn't call me back in 3 days and it's a customer service issue. Or, you know, we get those kind of complaints. So, or there's an actual serious, we need to look into this kind of thing.
So, frankly, just because it's not nearly as broad as homeowners and auto, you're not going to get Exactly. Sheer number is going to be hopefully lower, right? That would be.
No, it's definitely. Yeah.
Statistically, there's a numerus. So, yeah, that's interesting information. Thank you for sharing. I appreciate it.
Yeah, look up. I said, I don't qualify for the exemption.
Adjusters, do you license independent as well as kind of captive adjusters?
So Texas doesn't differentiate between an independent or staff adjuster. So if you're an adjuster, you need a license. That is different across states.
It is, yeah.
So there are states that don't license adjusters at all. And they come to Texas to get what they call designated home state. And so we vet them as if they are a resident. And then there are some states that only license independent adjusters and don't require a staff adjuster to hold a license. So adjuster licensing is not as clean and pretty as agent licensing, but we're getting there. We're good on it.
Why do we wait? What is the 90-day wait period? Like to not renew your license until you have to 90 days out? Is there a reason for that?
That's really rooted in statute of we send the renewal notice. We're required to send you a renewal notice 90 days before it expires. And so that's just the timer. That's the okay. That's the deemer of once you get that, that's when your invoice opens for renewal. Okay.
I was trying to pay.
Wouldn't save my money yet.
Hold on, lady.
Pay the next 10 years.
Yeah. Probably that too. Yeah, that's like.
Yeah. Thank you.
And as I said, I'm Amy Garcia. I'm the chief analyst over the financial analysis and company licensing and registration section, which is a whole long word, so I'm going to just call them CLR. I'm just going to give you kind of an overview of financial regulation and then kind of tie that into oversight. So from the financial regulation division, and I've been in the only area I've worked at in TDI. I've been there for 25 years, so lots of different roles within the division. We like to look at financial regulation as the life cycle of a company. As all insurers, whether they're surplus lines or just traditionals, but so we look at it cradle to grave, and we consider the company licensing section kind of the cradle, right? So that's where companies come in to get their initial license, registration, certificate, whatever form of approval they get from us. And the CLR section is broken down into two sections. So we have licensing and we have registrations. So on the licensing side, that's more your traditional insurers. That area is staffed with financial analysts. When a company applies for an application for a new license or an acquisition or redomestication, it goes through that side. Those type of applications are far more rigorous than a registration. Those companies, you know, they have to do an in-depth financial review. There's a business plan review. And then when looking at the fitness and competency of the ownership of those companies. And that team does look at the domestic surplus lines insurers. Now, the other side is the registrations area, and that area is staffed with compliance analysts. Stephanie is the team lead over that area. She's your question person for foreign surplus lines because they come through registrations since they don't actually, they're not like authorized insurers, so they are only registered. That area really focuses on looking at compliance with statute and regulations for registration. There's not so much of an emphasis on the financials of those types of companies. In addition to the registration, so like of surplus lines, they also process entities like the TPAs, which a lot of companies use. They do corporate amendments, change of control for registered entities, do the alien and foreign surplus lines. So that's kind of like the birth, right? We've got a company now. And we kind of move on to the living stage where you're a toddler, maybe a teenager. Some of the companies get in trouble in those teenagers, right? It happens. And so that's where the kind of next to I didn't say there's five sections enough in financial reg. And so that's where financial analysis and examinations both are housed. So for financial analysis, usually team of analysts, right? And that's where they monitor all of the different filings that insurance companies make, as well as, I'm going to say DLSI from here on out for domestic surplus lines insurance, because it's also a mouthful. So traditional insurers and DLSIs all have to file annual statements, quarterly statements, supplementals. Traditionals also have to do registration statements. They have to do corporate governance documents, a plethora of different filings that they make with us. And so those analysts, they review each one of those items, and they create a risk profile for the company. And that kind of dictates how we monitor that company going forward. It kind of prioritizes them. You know, teenagers first, midlife folks last is usually the way it kind of goes. And then there's examinations. They're also kind of in the middle of life. All companies, traditional companies and DLSIs, get 5-year full scope examinations. So our exam teams actually go on site and they review the actual documents now through computer systems, but you know, they go out and validate that the financial statements. We do some exams on 3-year cycles. That's primarily HMO statutory requirement. But we can put any company on a 3-year cycle if they have, you know, issues that we feel like we need to look at more frequently. And then exams has the authority to call a target exam at any time. Generally, that would be with one of those troubled companies. We see a specific area that's of concern, call a target exam, and they just go out and examine that one piece that we're concerned about.
Amy, do you look at risk retention groups specifically? I know that's an issue nationally.
Our RGs are not.
They're not, okay.
So let me back that up. They could be. So in Texas, we only have one domestic RRG, and they would fall under that. We have a ton of foreign RRGs, and they are. We don't do exams on foreign companies. So the one we do, yeah. You only say no because we only have one, but that's correct.
Thank you.
So then, you know, you're done living and we get to the death of a company, and that comes in one of two ways. The other area under financial regulation is the supervisory interventions office. And that group is over receivership. So that is definitely end of life, right? There's two avenues in receivership. There's rehabilitation, and then there's liquidation. If a company is in rehabilitation, kind of means like, man, we might have a chance. They're, you know, the receiver is going to try to rehab them and send them, you know, back to the living group. 25 years, I've never seen that happen once. So, you know, it's there, but it must be rare, right? They usually go to liquidation, which is, you know, end of life. The other option is a company could just decide they no longer want to be in the business. Self runoff and a solvent runoff, and then their COA wins, they're done with their liabilities. I've never seen that happen either, but it's possible. And that's kind of the basics of financial regulation, 5 areas, life of the company. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how surplus lines fits into the work we do in FRD. I'm sure you all know, first and foremost, any company wishing to be an eligible surplus lines carrier has to file stamping office first, and then they file with TDI most of the time at the same time, but it is a joint effort to register a company. And then depending on the type of surplus lines carrier, there's two different pathways. So the first would be, and easier would be, a foreign surplus lines company. And that's a company that's domiciled in another state that wants to be able to also write in Texas. For them to register, it's a fairly simple process. The TDI form, FIN 422, that really lays out everything they have to file to register. It's three items, basically. They need to file their most recent financial statement, and we say file it, but we don't actually want it. There's a little footnote that says, if you file with the NAIC, don't send us this. We can go get it ourselves. We don't want to make companies duplicate. We don't want to duplicate. copy of their current COA in their domiciled state that shows they're in good standing. And then a description of the proposed writings in Texas. So it's really just those three items. And then y'all stamping office analyst who coordinates with our compliance analyst. And both areas are satisfied that all the requirements are met, which pretty minimal. They are registered. Once they're registered, y'all put them on the stamping office website. We put them on TDI's website, and then agents know that company is available to write. First, they have to get appointed and all of that, but they know they're out there. How's that?
I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt again. Do you use because the thoughts are fleeting, do you use the NAIC alien quarterly listing for alien companies? You do.
Yes. Yeah, all alien companies go through.
Thank you.
Once a foreign company is licensed, they're required to do the same financial filings like any other traditional insurer or domestic surplus lines. There's the annuals, the quarterlies, all the supplementals that I mentioned earlier. And that's actually for all companies. And then the other path is if a company wants to be a DLSI. It's a very different, more rigorous process. So domestic surplus lines follow the same process as a traditional insurer. They file using the NAIC's UCAA application, primary application. The NAIC has created a portal, the Appian portal. Mixed reviews, I love it, and the reason being is it has 12 tabs, and so it has every document that's required in the filing. And so the applicant can't get to the end and hit submit until they've actually responded to everything, which is great for us because then when we actually get a submission, it's a complete app. Now, some people are sneaky, put a blank PDF. Mm-hmm. Where does it be a document? because it doesn't actually, there's no AI built in, I guess, that says, oh, this is real. So it didn't take very long for people to figure out a way around the great system, but it's still better than what we used to have. So they'll go on, they'll do that application. And then, like I said, it's a lot more like a traditional insurer. So the owners of a DLSI do have to do biographical affidavits. They have to do third-party background checks and fingerprints, which is a lot different than just registering. So they go through that whole process. So we get that. They also do file still with the stamping office. So we do the same coordination before we approve them. We check in with the stamping office analyst, make sure we're all on the same page, and then they do get a license. So if the DLSI goes out to get to expand into other states and they get approved in another state, it kind of changes the status to some degree. They are then considered a multi-state company, which you don't see, if it's just a Texas only. And the way that changes for us is that makes that company subject to accreditation standards, to the NAIC's accreditation standards. So from a TDI perspective, it changes the level of monitoring that we have to do. It's just really at the end of the year, do they have the correct amounts? Plus, yep, good. Thumbs up. For these guys, they then come into the standards where we have to follow uniform review guidelines for them, and there's timelines that have to be followed to maintain NAIC standards. Concept behind that is that states can rely on each other since we're a state-based system. You know, if an Oklahoma company is writing in Texas, I want to make sure Oklahoma is maintaining the same standards we would. Same reciprocal concept as with the agents, right? So it does increase the level of oversight that we have on the DALA size. And that's kind of the process for the two different types of licensings. There's one other function through CLR that we coordinate with the stamping office, and that's late agent filers and late company filers. Referrals. So I think it's about this time every year that y'all send out invoices to agents to pay their late filing fees. We coordinate with y'all. The stamping office provides us that data. I think we usually try to give another one or two rounds at getting them to pay their fees. If they don't, we do enforcement referrals on each individual agent. I think last year there were 118 referrals, and then our enforcement area sent a letter and tries to get them to pay. Occasionally we do actually end up in hearings, which seems very odd because they always lose. I'm like, just pay your fine. Many years, I've yet to see one not lose. So, that's another service that we coordinate with y'all to those agents and that as well. I haven't seen the list yet, but I know it's coming.
So late filing rates, is it lower or higher than the average state? Do you have any feeling for that? Whether Texas is doing better or worse than some of the.
I really have no idea. I can say on most of our fees, like in financial, we've canceled almost all of our fees. We charge just about nothing. There's maybe three filings now that have fees. Yeah, and it is just HMOs that have them because they're in statute versus rule. But if there were fees and rules, we took them all out. So I think in general, we are much lower.
Several states have no late filing fee, but they also have different checks and balances to maintain the discipline to file. So in Texas, that is our sole remedy to make sure that everybody files on time. So other states, they may have the carriers reporting premium, and then they do kind of a back check and stuff like that. So there's a couple of other. For us, that's our best resource. So we don't have any other means of maintaining discipline and filing within the 60-day window.
One last question: do you regulate captives? Do you have a separate captive division at the department?
Well, it's all within the same section.
Misty.
I should go over. Sure, put together a captive law that created a position, a singular position for TDI that is a captive specialist. That's all they do.
And they're in your group?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, I have a big group.
Yeah. I had a fascinating conversation with a very agent broker one time about captives. So it was interesting. The premise of the discussion was captives that are buying surplus lines insurance for reinsurance purposes should be paying the reinsurance tax rate, not the surplus lines tax rate. So it was a very interesting discussion, but ultimately I think I justified it in their mind by saying, technically, every captive is surplus lines writer because they are not an admitted market. So it is definitely a non-admitted market, and a non-admitted tax rate should apply. I don't think he fully bought it, but we haven't had the discussion again in a long while. So they've either just given up trying to convince me, or maybe they've started trying to convince you. I don't know.
So the captives have a different tax rate than traditional insurers. I mean, plus lines is different from captives versus traditional. So
right, but if they're their argument was they're buying surplus lines specifically to reinsure whatever they're writing, right? And so they should have the 0.5% reinsurance rate, not the 4.85% surplus lines rate. It was a reasonable argument, but the hard part is, and now that I know that you guys, I don't have great, I have some awareness of the oversights and the rules associated in Texas with managing captives, but I wouldn't even know the route to go to, and it may not be, it probably is, you guys, quite frankly, but that's almost kind of a comptroller discussion more than you or me, but you and I usually are the ones that people will ask first, so it's an interesting one.
I had not heard that.
Yeah, it was a fun conversation that I finally had to, only because I had to think my way out of it. I was like, well, that's not, because there's a lot to it, right? If you really were using it as reinsurance, and you wanted to justify, I think if you wanted to justify that to the comptroller, the stamping office would have to prove that it is reinsurance through some ceded premium agreement. And that was kind of the idle threat, is like, I would have to be all involved in your captive business. So much like a DSLI carrier, we would have to, there's only one way to know that you were using it as reinsurance premium, is that is your ceding premium to some part of your organization. We wouldn't know that without looking at your finances routinely. And I think that probably scared them away as much as anything.
I was going to say, their financial statements are one of the few that are confidential.
Yeah, it would be tough, right? And I know from our history, we wouldn't want to. We would have just said, let's pay the surplus lines tax. Let's not get everybody involved in our finances. So I understand that.
I think if it came out, okay, that could happen, but you're going to have to make everything public.
Yeah, exactly. No thanks. Yeah.
I asked about captives too, because I represent the Vermont Captive Association, which is the largest domicile. I know Christine Brown, the deputy. We work very closely with her in financial regulation. And there's a self-procurement tax issue where some captive managers are moving their, I think they're moving their captives to Texas so that it will align where the risk is, and they'll avoid having to pay the self-procurement tax. So that's becoming a national issue, so that it's in all our best interest that states don't try to compete with each other to avoid that, but that's for another day. But so procurement taxes are taxes that people, well, you guys know better. People pay when they don't use a broker and they access the insurance market directly. But it's at a different rate, I understand, from the regular rate. So it might even be a different rate than the reinsurance statute. I'm not sure.
The self-procurement tax?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. The reinsurance tax is very, very low.
Very well. Yeah. So it must be higher than that. So it's a burgeoning issue. Would be interesting. Now, I can't talk at all tomorrow because I've already gone over my allotted number.
Amy, thank you for that. That was very interesting. Just for our board members, who you'll see the names and you see the faces of the people, carrier approval, that generally goes through Ronnie's group, and Yuba is the one that does all of that math and or email analysis. So the internally for us, it's through Ronnie's group that interacts with the folks at TDI whenever a new application is made, or if somebody doesn't have. So just so you know, the capital and surplus, not alien, but for foreign and DSLI, the capital and surplus requirement is $15 million. And so if anybody doesn't have that or doesn't maintain that, then it's our job to say, hey, you need to supplement that $15 million. Doesn't happen very often, quite frankly, but
we had one this last year, didn't we?
Yeah. We actually had one just a few weeks ago.
Okay.
So it's not unheard of, but it's very definitely not frequent by any stretch either. So it happens, but doesn't happen very frequently. So it's kind of.
I should mention the director of our company license, Andrew Guerrero. Yeah. He usually comes to these. He's on vacation.
Oh, is he on vacation? He's okay. I guess we'll let him go on vacation every once in a while. Thank you for that. That was great.
I don't have any questions about, I guess, like board appointment stuff. If you guys ever do, I'm not the person. I'll throw it out there. Me. Just about that process. I'm here or always reach me.
So for you, I would just say, how early in the process is it helpful for us to get involved at all? Try and recruit, right? So that maybe that's the better question. So,
I mean, anytime that you are aware that you're gonna, when you become aware that you might make a change, whether it be with your employer or anything that would be related to life, where you may not want to seek reappointment, like you can let me know as soon as you know that or you've made that decision. I would say from like an application perspective for new applicants, I mean, you know, within a couple of months of when your position would like open back up, that we would also be actively seeking applications. We try not to take applications like, say, with terms expiring generally at the end of December. I'd be really hesitant to get an application from y'all to be considered for reappointment in June because life happens, right? So I would hate to have you submit an application and then, you know, something happened in October, good, bad, hopefully good, and then, you know, have to refill something back out or anything like that. So, you know, I would say definitely, you know, October is probably good. Generally, that's when we try to post, to try to reach out, you know, about a month and a half to 2 months in advance. I will say that this year, I mean, maybe I'll lean more towards like very early October, just because the pre-filing for bills start. And a lot of the folks that are involved in our appointments process are also very involved in the bill pre-filing and all of that fun hoopla. So just a delicate balance. I mean, but I'm available anytime. So, you know, worst comes to worst, you do submit something, you know, you're like, yes, I want to serve again. And you send me something, you know, we send your application back, like, hey, has anything changed? We really try to like be pretty reasonable about that. One thing I will mention to y'all, since we're here in this space, for the last few years, I've been trying to carry this project to conclusion, and it will be nearing conclusion hopefully this year. And we're going to switch our applications from that dreaded PDF form to an online web-based form. That will be better. We are a little bit limited, of course, being a state agency with resources. So it is not the most fancy form you've ever seen in the world with it being web-based. But hopefully it makes it much better, because the primary thing is that it doesn't let you skip a question that we need the answer to in order to, in this instance, reappoint you. And that's a huge thing, is that you'll a lot of times hear from me where you'll submit something and it's like, hey, you checked like yes on page 3 to question 18, like, can you get this back to me? And it's just sludge, right? Like, it's just pure sludge. And it's not good for both sides, because we want to try to get letters reissued as quickly as possible. So hopefully that will get done. I was hoping to have that rolled out in December of last year, but the platform we're using, Clive, you know, anytime you use technology, it always takes how much more longer. So I'm hoping that by the summer we'll be able to get through that. But of course, you know, there will be communication about that before there's any sort of, you know, major transition. I just need more time to get the IT in the background working and getting it good. So, because I'm Geek Squad's worst nightmare, so I had to put other people on that. So
so when we have a situation like what we went through with Ezekiel, so if one is going to renew, they want to be reappointed, Should they call you before, should we be calling you prior to, let's just say, get another license, make a life change in our careers or something like that?
That would be ideal. Again, if you think there is something that could impact, quite frankly, eligibility to continue to serve or to be considered in advance, like, please let us know. Unfortunately, by and large, you know, we're confined to statutory requirements. And we see a lot of times that, you know, that plays a hard role in being able to, with some of our boards, oh my gosh, the length of things that you cannot be to serve as a public member is ridiculous. We have to play by those rules. It's not necessarily what the rules we want to play by because we want people to serve. And we want to put everybody in a spot that is eager to serve, that is qualified. So if you think that something might be changing, let me know. You can call anytime. Like, seriously. I'm available anytime you want to chat. If you're like, I'm thinking about doing this, I want to do this. What does that look like? You know, we do want to know, because although I'm sitting here next to Jody, I don't know exactly what's going on the licensing side of things on a day-to-day yeah. basis. And so it can be a little challenging, on the day-to-day side to kind of figure out, you know, what's going on in the licensing side versus what's going on in the appointment side, because they're not being ran necessarily together. So we do a lot of our backgrounds and our checks for board appointment items separate and on a different timeline than for agent and adjuster licensing issues.
Is there a term limit for board members? I forgot.
Not for surplus lands. There was, and I believe that got removed.
Oh.
So I think the only board that TDI has a role in that does have consecutive term limits is the TWIA board. Texas Windstorm Insurance. So I think every board does. And if you love what you're doing and you want to serve on another board, hey, come back. You know, as I like to say, the prize for winning the pie eating contest is more pie. So if you want to continue to be involved, we always have openings on our website. We have a lot of boards that serve on multiple boards too. So, and if you find yourself in a position in which, you know, you might not have work responsibilities or things that align with surplus lines, but you still want to serve in some capacity, like, let us know. Because again, we have like 10 or 12 boards ish at any given time. Things kind of change and fluctuate that we're statutorily tied to, with over 100 positions in which we have a hand in the appointments of. So there's a lot of opportunity there. So if you ever chose to take on more or want to shift in your role. And we do try to take a lot of people who do apply. If they're not eligible or not selected to serve in a particular board, we try to ask them if there's another spot that they can slot into another board. We try to fit them in there. So we really do try to keep everybody serving, and who wants to serve, give them a chance. But again, yeah, we're confined to the statutory requirements, which is usually where we see a lot of the complications play in. So unfortunately.
The moral of the story is call you first, really.
Yeah,
I mean, because we wouldn't have had that situation had we even thought about it when he got the risk manager's license. Yeah.
Are you comfortable with us sharing that type of information? So Leslie and I have a presentation in the summer at
Texas Insurance Law Section.
Right. The law section of the state board.
Yeah, of course.
There's going to be a lot of candidates, maybe not for our board, too many, but across 10 to 12 statutory ties and 100 spots. Are you comfortable with us sharing that? Or?
Absolutely, yeah. I'll get with you. I can send you the link to make sure you have it to our pages. You can give them my contact information. We're constantly trying to do outreach. We even are in contact a lot with the appointments office at the governor's office, because they have a lot of people that apply for those boards that may not fit. So we're trying to work smarter in terms of getting the word out, and people who want to serve, like finding places for them to serve. So, and a lot of the boards have, you know, a mix of industry versus public. So even if someone is, you know, like adjacent to an industry, they might be able to serve, or we can find a different type of insurance related board where they might be considered a public member and eligible, where their knowledge of insurance and things in general is very, very useful.
Presenting to the young, presentations to young, new attorneys.
Yeah.
They can be new. They don't have to be young, I guess, but That's who we're presenting to. So
yeah, we have a lot of attorneys that serve on boards. Yeah. So yeah, that's great. You know, people that are like, you know, title adjacent, we have the title guarantee insurance board. Let's see, like if you've got like the automobile industry, there's those things. I mean, any board, again, they've got public and a mix of public and industry and things like that. So yeah.
Thank you all so much for this. This was great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we're happy to be here.
I appreciate it.
I don't know how we fell off the wagon, but we're always happy to be here. Always happy to come and connect to you.
Super insightful, right? It's like you think of so many ways. I mean, we work together all the time, right? But those day-to-day things, I don't necessarily share with the board. You know, that's not true. Carriers that don't make their compulsory $15 million probably get notified. But just kind of the day-to-day stuff is not necessarily shared every month with our board members. So I appreciate you coming, giving me a lot of reminders of things that I need to add to my activity report. So thank you very much.
Yeah, you know, one of the questions I always get all the time is people when I'm doing the expert witnessing is agent broker, you know, and that they always go, and so many people that are calling themselves brokers, and everybody thinks there's this agent license and then there's broker's license, especially in the state of Texas. And some states do have the difference. But, you know, that's every time, like when I'm being deposed, well, are they an agent or a broker? I'm like, we're in Texas. They're the same thing. And they just will. They do not. Sometimes they don't want it. You know how those lawyers are.
States say producer. That's really where it's moving to, is producer.
Yeah, producer. Always interesting though.
Well, lunch is here, hopefully still warm, so feel free to jump up and grab something. And then for those of you that are on Pete Rubin, we're gonna probably just put everything on pause for about an hour or 45 minutes. We'll jump back on at 1. Is that fair?
Yeah, I can just
stop recording and then half the recording, but then you have 45 minutes of silence. So.
Yeah. Either I can cut it out later. Put it on mute. That way nobody has to rejoin. Oh my gosh.
All right. Okay. You go to the next slide.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. This is my fault. I'm making her do this. She's not going to know when I change slides until the top of the page. So let's So, Jeff, you asked about the timing of your reappointment. Your appointment does expire in 2026.
It does.
So, this is the last year.
You have to reapply.
I just did.
Can you talk about it privately and then let me know?
You can see all the, one of the things we'll point out here, right, is so on the lower left-hand side, we do have committee appointments that will need to be made tomorrow. I guess for the folks that aren't here, you can sign them.
Just put them on there.
Chair. I think Ryan will be here.
Oh, darn it.
He did say he was coming tonight.
Okay.
You guys all heard about the did she say that? Here to everyone,
no licensing.
No, the open public member. They have an applicant for it, but because of NAIC, they're not going to be able to get to it until sometime in the near future. So that's fine.
Okay.
So it's not a no. It's just on pause right now.
To me, it sounded like there's somebody in the queue that is probably going to be
appointed,
but it's just they don't have the time. So
do we need to be trying to reach out still and get somebody?
I don't think so. Now, if Katie says next week, hey, we declined the person that applied, then yeah, we'll have to have.
But if anybody that's coming up in 2026, if they don't want to, it sounds like we need to be letting her know so that we can fill the queue with another person.
So I put it on my notes early October.
Okay.
So that is Nick, Jeff, and you.
Because I was trying to think of when we got Ezekiel and Jason, when I was calling them because they didn't get that packet. It was Pete, Ezekiel, and Jason all came up at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we had to call all of them to get their packet, for them to sign those packets, because they were like due. I thought that was like June or July that we did that.
Well,
you know.
You're okay. I wrote down
October. She said October. Okay.
Start thinking about it. I'll send those reminders out in October.
Okay.
So not a lot has changed on this from previous years. So maybe more opportunity for discussion. Mind-numbingly rolling through all the data, but we're going to go through the board overview, the who we are, the organization, talk about operations, IT, finance. So first and foremost, the primary objective of the board is to ensure that the board and stamping office assist TPI by performing the duties outlined in the technical action and plan of operation. Board acts with meaningful oversight of financials, operations, and policy guidance in a way that ensures integrity and effective management while allowing the executive director to make day-to-day operational decisions. So that's it. And I will say, I interact with our peer network of stamping offices often enough that this makes us unique. You won't hear many of our peer offices that talk much more beyond their members. Now, we don't have members, right? But we're different and unique in that we don't have members, and we're not taking care of our members. Say it. So it's just a different type of organization compared to the other stamping offices that are around. So board composition in terms, we talked about this, 9 members, 5 non-public. That is not defined. Public is defined. So by default, everything that falls out of square with public members becomes the opportunity for us. That is the difference with Ezekiel. So if Ezekiel wanted to be on the board, he could still be a non-public.
That's what I was thinking.
And then the public member, the requirements are can't be an officer, director, or employee of an insured, insurer, an agency, a brokerage, or an adjuster, or any other business entity regulated by the department. Also cannot be a lobbyist and not really spokes as well. 3-year terms can be reappointed. And then we must sign annually the forms that are in the blue package for you. Serve without compensation, but may be reimbursed for expenses that are incurred as part of traveling to these meetings. So next slide, duties and rights. Highest duty of trust and confidence for fiduciary duty to protect the assets of the stamping office. Always act in the best interest of the stamping office. And then a duty of care, prudent use of stamping office assets, both all facility, people, and goodwill. Rights as board member. So every board member has the right to access stamping office management personnel, books, records, and facilities. So any of the information that we have generally is available to you when it comes to managing this organization. Access to meeting minutes. Those are all online, actually. So if you ever needed meeting minutes, they're always available to you. You have the right to receive notice of board meetings. Those probably come more frequently than you prefer. That's what we do these days. You have the right to comment and respectfully disagree with items that are discussed. The right to access services of or communicate with general counsel. And the right to vote in agreement or disagreement or abstain from voting. There's other things that are in the plan of operation that we'll discuss throughout this slide deck. So we do have 4 committees. The first one is the executive committee. So we were required by the plan of operation to elect a chair, a vice chair, and a secretary, and they become the executive committee, those officers. And primarily that executive committee is responsible for monitoring my performance, as well as nominating candidates for board officer positions. So you guys know this process well enough to know that that's generally done either at dinner or, or in the case of the discussion, immediately before or after. So those are, you shouldn't have to wait on the executive committee. If you want to participate as a board member in a leadership capacity, I can promise you that will be afforded you. So feel free to reach out. We also have the Finance and Audit Committee that is also required by the plan of operation. It is responsible for quarterly financials. Oh, I just remembered. I was going to ask Amy. So I've heard or I read that federal government is considering removing the quarterly reporting for SEC requirements and going to biannual. Yeah. Would that change for us as well? And I've recognized, like, this is all speculation.
Left field for me there. So I can look into it for you if you want, though. And I'll get out of that.
Consider it.
Be surprised if, truthfully, dependent on the federal initiative. I'm not sure, to be honest, at all. So that's fair. I have to look into it. But
yeah, I totally forgot until I read the word quarterly. It's like, oh, ask that.
That's walking in the other room and forgetting what you were doing.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. But anyway, we also have plan of operation committee. And just to give quick update on that, we'll do this tomorrow as well. But the plan of operation amendments are waiting on, David, I'm going to get this wrong, one person. One human at TDI needs to sign off on those plan amendments, and then they'll come back to us with what was accepted or adopted and what wasn't. And then the commissioner will sign those. And this is probably all in here, but since we're talking about this committee. So tomorrow, the plan of operation committee won't really have much of a task to do other than just say, we're waiting on one person to take a look at it. So it'll be pretty easy. We also have a board orientation committee. So this was one, and what we do is we just send an email out to the folks that are on that committee and say, hey, did you have any suggestions for improvement to this document? And this thing should be evergreen, right? So as the organization grows and changes, everything about orientation should grow and change with it. So this particular year, there wasn't a lot to add. That's the one beauty of continuity, and not one, but one of many beauty of continuity on board members is this becomes kind of a perfunctory detail. The reason we had to do it is because back in the day when three people were changing out every year, you were really losing that knowledge and continuity over and over and over again. So this is one of the benefits of doing this. We could kind of go, quite frankly, a lot deeper into subject matter because it's not three new people every year. So certainly thankful for that. And then the responsibility of the committee members to act on behalf of the board and work with anyone SLTX on assignments to understand the process and then report back to the full board. That's the one thing none of our committees that I can think of can make decisions fully on behalf of, even the executive committee can.
Yeah.
So no committee has the authority of the board at their disposal. So anything the committee were to decide would have to be a recommendation to the full board for consideration. So that's kind of unique. Some boards kind of push it all out to their committees and let the committee
do it. And still under the operations, we still have to, we're doing those committee meetings. That's part of what we've been trying to change, right? Where we don't have to post everything, so and
part of the plan of operation changes that will be hopefully be amended.
Yes.
Because three member committees complying with the Open Meeting Act is very challenging. So we're going to change. That was one of the suggested amendments to the operation.
You just can't get together and have your meeting, you know, have a discussion. We would have to.
Yeah, the notify, right?
Notify and do all the notifications and stuff.
7-day notification and all this other fun stuff that makes it nearly impossible. You can't send an email because two people is a quorum. Yeah, it was really, it's a great idea. The spirit of the Meeting Act, it's a great idea.
Yeah.
But when you have those kinds of rules, technically you just can't, it's very challenging to actually
be effective.
So Typical meeting schedule is 5 meetings, and that's all we budgeted for this cycle this year, is kind of the 4 quarterly meetings, and then 1 budget adoption meeting in October. And you guys are all familiar that that is normally, we'll do that online, along with the second quarter meeting that is usually in June. We usually try to do those online. That way you don't have to travel too much to come here. And, you know, if there were anything particularly contentious, obviously you can have as many meetings as you need in order to have the discussions that need to be had. So it's not a limitation. This is just typical. We typically can do this in 5 meetings. All meetings must comply with the Open Meeting Act. You guys know that. And they must be held in Texas. This is a unique one. Talking to other stamping offices, they are all going to, it used to be called the Western States Organization. Now it's called CIWA, California Insurance Wholesalers Association. There's an inordinate number of stamping offices that are all going to CIWA. It's in Monterey, California. Very beautiful, right? It's in July. So Monterey in July is where you want to be. It's definitely not Austin. But they're all taking their whole board there, and they're all having board meetings. And so, of course, we're having meetings earlier in the week, and they're like, Greg, who are you bringing? That's me. We're not allowed to have our board meetings in anywhere but Texas. So if you guys want to come to Austin instead of Monterey, no one So yeah, kind of a unique difference.
The only stamping office that applies to that situation?
Or as I know, they go everywhere. And then we have to notify TDI of all meetings at least 3 business days in advance of the public posting date, which is 7 days prior to the meeting. So generally speaking, everything has to be TDI within 10 or 10 days prior to the meeting. Now, this is the one meeting where TDI kind of allows us some grace because we have so much stuff going on, like our new favorite auditors. They didn't get us the audit until 1:45 yesterday afternoon. So TDI is very graceful in saying that if you have it, send it. But if you don't have it, don't panic. Just get it to us when you can. So this is the one meeting every year because of the annual meeting. We're dependent on a lot of external organizations to give us information and data that we normally don't have. So it's kind of a struggle, but that 10-day thing, we've kind of got it all figured out, quite frankly. With the exception of this meeting, we're pretty good about that. And then parliamentary procedures, we follow Robert's Rules of Order. You'll see more about that on the back page, if you want to, of this document. But I think everybody's familiar with how to signal a motion. So the OMA, the Open Meeting Act, the plan of operation requires that all board meetings comply with the open meeting and be held in Texas. So that means public notice for a group constituting a quorum. So it's the way it's a quorum of those present. So it doesn't always have to be 5 of 9. It's just a majority, I guess, with the simple majority. Now, there are some things in the plan that require 2/3 vote instead of a simple majority. And one of them is the audit, I think. So there's a couple of things that require 2/3 vote versus just simple quorum majority. But generally speaking, when we vote on stuff, it's almost always unanimous anyway. So it hasn't come up as hasn't created a problem for us at all. Notice must be provided to the Secretary of the State at least 7 days before the meeting. So that's something that you guys probably don't even see, right? We send that to the board. We save all that stuff, but it truly does go to the SOS, and they post it on their website, and the public in general can see it if they're so inclined. You can vote and act on anything that is on the agenda. So that's one of the things. It used to, I guess, be kind of a contentious thing. We word our agendas differently. That's kind of allowed discussion for really anything. But there was a time several years ago where it was just like presentation only, and nobody was allowed to. So you'd suffer through these meetings all day and then not get to discuss it. It was pretty tough. And then video participation is somewhat less restrictive, but again, even then, the chair has to be physically present at the meeting. This is one of those things we're going to figure out, because my goal is, before I retire, we're going to not have a building. And so that means we're going to do this in somewhere very public locations, at hotels and conference centers, things like that. And I figure that out as we move on. Can you go to the next slide for me?
Which is important about the video too, is your home, if you're at home and doing it, that you've got to
be seen and
seen. Yeah. Because sometimes, you know, you think you'll be on the, in the car or something doing it, and it's really not very effective.
Right. Yeah. Seen and heard is can be a challenge. Sometimes just the technical challenge, right? We just don't have the bandwidth to be seen and heard.
Seen and heard.
We've done that, right? We're all in the car and can hear you, or I can see you. Yeah. So that is a kind of a weird technicality that sometimes we'll run into. So, which you'll see, we'll just back up and say, you're going to have to turn your camera on or something like that. So, but that is only board members. So when we're presenting, because wasn't it, you got stuck and you had to present from your truck.
Yeah.
So last year.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was, so Ronnie did not have to be seen. Obviously, she had to be heard so she could present.
But I was seen. So like September, I think.
Yeah, but technically didn't have to be seen. Could have just been heard. So I don't think there's anything big or surprising associated with the Public Information Act, other than really, you know, I put it in the activity report, how many open record requests we get. So I give you kind of a summary of what all of them look like. But it's unfortunate that you cannot detail how much effort goes into answering or not answering these questions, because usually the requests are just vague enough. You have to have 5 follow-up emails, and what are you looking for and why, and you're not allowed to ask that, so you have to be very kind of roundabout in your discussion of, hey, you know, this is my interpretation of what you're asking for is this, we don't have that, would this, instead of exhibit A, would exhibit B work? It has all of this content in it. So it turns into lots of conversation. Okay, so let's move on to the stamping office. So we were created through the legislative process back in Senate Bill 989 back in 1987. That is a photocopy of the actual bill that's in there too. So, and the other thing is the SLTS, we unofficially rebranded ourselves back in 2016 from FLSOT, which is simply just the Surplus Line Stamping Office of Texas, right? The acronym. We rebranded ourselves to SLTX. So, but that is not recognized in statute. So it kind of depends on who we're talking to. In my emails, whether you hear me say SLTX or the stamping office. The stamping office is generally recognized as a statutory name. So if we're doing something kind of quasi-official, I'll use stamping office. And if I'm doing something that's just more business of stamping office, I'll use SLTX.
Nobody really knows what the word stamping.
No. That is lost to...
He's a stamping it.
Lost to the sands of time. Some people stamp the notification, right? The guarantee fund notification. Some people consider it a stamp kind of like Lloyd's, when you would follow around your policy and stamp all of the various participants. And then the stamping office would stamp that all of these participants were eligible carriers. And so the actual... You'll get various answers to what stamping was, but for me, I'm just consistently saying we don't stamp anything.
Yeah.
There's no stamp from us, so we don't do that. So organizationally, not much has changed. You guys remember last year, right, with the loss of Cheyenne, we talked about some reorganization, and we really didn't do it other than we changed some responsibilities. So what happened was director of operations was changed to strictly, if you will, policy intake analysis, which is still was already 95% of all the operations tasks anyway. And then other people were reallocated primarily to IT. So So Alonda's team is almost as large as Toby's team these days. And then Christian, who will be in here for the Finance and Audit Committee discussion on stamping fees, and then tomorrow for the full board meeting. He drew the short straw and reports directly to me because he handles all the data. Doesn't really fit in the operations side or in the IT side. Unfortunately for him, he gets moved forward. And then no changes really for finance and HR with the exception of Yuba. That is one of the things analyzing carriers for eligibility was something that Cheyenne handled back in the day. And so that is one of the things that we moved under Ronnie and Yuba. Still, Yuba had that responsibility even when he reported to Cheyenne. And so his individual responsibility didn't really change, but the reporting structure did just a little bit. Kind of made sense to me. The financial analysis of carriers should be through the director of finance. So kind of fit that. But really no change to the organizational structure. So still kind of four pillars. Four legs to the stool. Okay, so 981 is kind of everything. It's not everything, but it's a lot of statutory surplus lines provisions. So it establishes the stamping office. It establishes the board, provides a plan of operation, provides powers and duties of the office, grants supervisory authority over the stamping office to the commissioner of insurance, provides immunity from liability. For officers, agents, and employees, provides an exemption from the Public Information Act. This is such an important one that you'd be shocked how often we use it for individual policies. And then the other thing is it does not grant enforcement authority to the stamping office. And I think that's an important one because a lot of people, we get, you know, there's two ways to encourage people, right? You can whips and carrots, right? We, by design, are not given any whips. We are only given carrots. So we can only encourage people to do their job correctly. And unfortunately, if they don't, there is an enforcement authority that will enforce the rules if and when they don't. So our job is truly in the good cop, bad cop role. We're always the good cop. So it's hard to be TDI sometimes. But by statute, we always get to be the good cop. So that is not well known. There's a lot of people that truly believe that we as a stamping office have kind of carte blanche authority to do kind of crazy things associated with legislative processes and regulatory processes that we just absolutely do not have the authority to do. Doesn't mean we can't call those who do have the authority, hey, we need your help. And so it's still a good idea to work with us on that. But you'd be shocked how many people think they don't like the way the law is written. So they're just going to call the stamping office and tell them to change it. So it's surprisingly less simple than that. So kind of an interesting thing. So moving on to the plan of operation. So the TIC, the TAC, the TIC and the TAC both established that the commissioner must approve the plan of operation. And then in the TAC, there's some verbiage that talks about any amendment becomes effective on written approval by commissioner order. And then you can see B there talking about proposed amendments. We've talked about this a little bit already.
Bless you.
C, if the stamping office fails to submit any amendments, the commissioner may amend it on their own. And that happened back in 2020. So as far as I know, that's the only time it's ever happened. Usually it comes from the board through the board to the commissioner works the normal way. But back in 2020, I think Commissioner Sullivan at that time just got tired of waiting on that stuff happens.
The TDI cannot initiate amendment on its own.
It can. Yeah. Right. If yes, they can. would be the best way to say that. I was going to say it, we failed to, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what failed.
We've never really meted that out. David, I'd have to ask for your.
It fits another one. I'll say off the top of my head, I'm not sure as to whether or not we'd go in unilaterally.
Yeah.
Again, I think historically it's always been. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Much better that way, right? So, so we don't want to test that.
No.
We're going to see if the commissioner wants to. Then we must post it on the approved plan of operation on our website. Kind of an interesting thing, right? Because by default, you would argue this means we have to have a website. In theory, most companies wouldn't have to, right? But this, in theory, creates the requirement that you have to have a website. And then finally, the last one, when we talk about changing the stamping fee, and we will talk about that, that has to be posted for a 20-day comment period. I won't steal all of Christian's thunder. He's worked way too hard on that presentation for me to talk about it. But if the board recommends a change to the stamping fee, then it would go to the commissioner. If the commissioner agreed, it would be posted for a 20-day public comment. But interesting, though, that's only for a change. So if you do nothing is the decision, then that does not have to be posted for, which I think is otherwise we'd be getting 20 every year. So that would be kind of fun. Okay. Plan of operation, the responsibilities of the board members are outlined. Standing office is governed by a board of directors appointed by the commissioner. Responsibilities are to oversee the stamping office, ensure that we conduct operations prudent and in a prudent and fiscally responsible manner that is consistent with statutory obligations. Hire an executive director by plan of operation. Technically, there only has to be one employee here. The executive director is the only one that's mandated to be hired. So kind of interesting. that would be one very fat brained human being.
That's not me.
I don't have a brain anywhere near that fat. So it would be a very impressive human to do this without the team that we have. So, and the board cannot delegate its oversight responsibility or functions to govern. So I don't really understand the basis behind that. You can't hire a third party to do your job for you. So it's kind of why would you? It's kind of an interesting one, but I understand that's probably there for a reason. Continuing on with responsibilities, right? Manage the affairs, property, and business of the staffing office. Select, hire, and employ an executive director. Develop policies that address all aspects of company management and performance. And then there are three that are specifically called out here. So the travel and expense policy, the investment and cash management policy, which Ronnie will review this afternoon in the F&A committee, and then a competitive bidding. Those three were specifically added back in 2020 when the plan of operation was amended. Also have to provide for an annual independent audit and propose and adopt an annual budget. And then when it comes to liability, indemnity, and insurance, so the TIC grants immunity from liability to board members and the department for acts or omissions in performing statutory power or duty. The plan indemnifies all present and past board members and current employees. And then the stamping office purchase insurance to protect and appropriately board members. So on to the facts. These are always fun. So you can see the top on this slide is the growth in premium. I know that's hard to read, but that is premium from start to finish. So that premium goes back to the summer of 1988 when it started and goes to the end of 2025 at $18.2 billion. So, which is always kind of fun to look at just from the context of the stamping office was created in 1987 by statute because premium had gone up so much. And if you look at that number, it had gone up to $200 million. So It's a totally different world than it was back when we were created in 1988, but or 1987. But it's just everything about this business is growing. And so you can see it's 14% average annual growth over the last 10 years. And then the 2005 reported premium set records in 9 of the 12 months. Next slide has the first top left is the same thing, right? That's premium. But when you're comparing premiums and filings, you see the growth. Filings really grew more consistently than even premium did. So we only had one non-record month on policy filings, and that was November. Every other month, that green line on the far right-hand side top box set a new record for policies submitted to us in a month. And then you can see on the bottom, that's combination of policies and all the other pieces of a policy that get filed with us. And so studying the volume of information that comes to this organization has never been higher. It is amazing the amount of data that we get these days. So comparing stamping offices, I tell this joke fairly routinely. When I first started, my first or second day, the stamping office director, executive director in Illinois called me. His name is David Okasik, and he called me and he said, Greg, if you know one stamping office, you know one stamping office. Every time I meet with them, I bring that statement up because we all do everything so differently, but this is as close to an apples-to-apples comparison as you can make, right? Because my joke that I tell the TSLA folks all the time is, you know, it is not a competition, but there is a leaderboard. And if you, depending on what you measure as lead, Texas is generally speaking going to be number two or number three every year. California is always historically number one, both in premium. Not always, it's not unusual for Texas to have a higher California. It would be very unusual for Texas to have a higher item count than Florida. So Florida will flip-flop back and forth with us for premium, but they are almost always the highest on item count. And then you can see the comparison of stamping fees and surplus lines tax by state there as well. One thing I will point out, Florida just announced they're cutting their fee in half in July. So they're going from 0.06% to 0.03%. Which would be the lowest ever for any stamping office. So that's a pretty substantial cut. A lot of people like this policy or this slide. I like it too, but I generally, what I like about it is most people perceive surplus lines to be big, complex, complicated policies that cost tens of thousands or millions of dollars. And that is not the case really at all. The surplus lines is still an integral part of running a small business because most 66% of all policies had a premium of $5,000 or less. So surplus lines is just frankly an integral part of the insurance market these days. It's not, it is intended for big, complex, weird things that can't be insured in the admitted market, but it has grown past that as well. And I would say that points to the importance of excess. These days, particularly in the admitted market, you just can't get the limits that you're looking for. You have to turn to other markets to get everything that you need. So that's it for my slides.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I would like to briefly walk you through the role of the operations department. and how we support our industry. So our team focuses on making sure filings are received, reviewed, and processed accurately, while also helping ensure that surplus lines transactions meet state regulatory requirements. In simple terms, operations helps keep the system running smooth by reviewing filings, supporting brokers, and providing information to regulators. We work closely with agents, brokers, and the Texas Department of Insurance to make sure surplus lines filings are compliant, complete, and properly reported. This helps maintain transparency in our data and supports the regulatory oversight required by the state law. This slide shows what our team actually does on a day-to-day basis. So first, we process filings that come in from agents and brokers. Some of these are submitted as paper filings, which means they send them by mail, where our team reviews the documents, checks that everything follows the applicable rules and statutory requirements. Many filings today are submitted electronically through our smart system. Our team supports smart users by helping with technical questions and assisting agents who submit automated or manual electronic filings. We also conduct policy audits. So during those reviews, we check policy data, confirm calculations, and help identify missing or incorrect information so it can be corrected. In addition to reviewing filings, the operations team responds to calls and emails from agents and brokers who have questions about compliance or coding or filing requirements. We also analyze filing data. We monitor late filing reports, and we conduct outreach to users when we see common errors or issues that need clarification. Overall, our goal is to support compliance, improve filing accuracy, and help answer questions.
Question? Yeah. Broker fees, some states consider them part of premium, which in turn would be subject to tax. The insurer requires it as opposed to it not being mandatory. Is there any distinction like that in Texas, I think?
So the only thing that they do is list out the what they consider a fee. So it can be like a broker fee, a stamping fee, agent fee. And they do consider that taxable and part of
it. Part of premium. Yeah.
So to close, I'd like to recognize that the operations team for their outstanding work that they do every day and their attention to detail, regulatory requirements to commit to, and their commitment to supporting agents and brokers, which is critical to the success of our organization. What really stands out is how well this team works together. They consistently support one another and take pride in making sure the work is done accurately and efficiently. Very proud of this team and grateful for their dedication and professionalism they bring to SLTX.
I'll make it kind of short. IT is kind of boring to most people. You start talking IT, everybody get glazy eyes. So I just kind of broke it down in some of the categories, the main categories that we're responsible for. We have all of our, we used to have a data center in-house. Now our data center is actually in Microsoft Azure environment, and we do management of that. So we basically, all of our stuff is mostly virtual. So we have virtual switches. We have some switches that are located here in the office that controls the office and controls the connection back to Microsoft. But mostly everything is basically virtual now. It's very nice. Less stressful. We are responsible for the smart project development. So we plan, organize, manage. We have started doing user groups that is for the continuous smart development. So we do user groups both internal and external. We haven't done any internal while. Our next external user group is in April. So we've kind of coordinated all that into everything that we're doing, and we are doing a bunch of moving parts right now. And the other thing is that we do the enterprise level integration. So anything like we add in the cloud services, anytime we need, like we have ChatGPT, we have Microsoft integrations, we have Jira, we have Adobe. There's a whole bunch of moving parts that we integrate into our day-to-day environment to make everybody's life easier. So we're responsible for all of those. We do have external cloud integrations, which is our Azure, which is basically the backbone of what we do. And we also have the other external integration is our Azure backup. which all of our data and all of our servers are actually backed up and Azure into two different places. So we have two different data centers that we use in Azure. So we keep both of those synced up on a daily basis. It's a daily check to make sure all the syncs are working, but we do not like to keep all of our eggs in one basket. So if something does happen in one data center, we have another one. Even though they're both ran by Microsoft, they're in two different regions. One's East Coast, one's West. So we do the data governance. So we maintain all the data and the integrity of the data, which we do that through Azure. We have the data governance set up in Azure to make sure all of our data is following the lines of what we have. Our departments are separated. The only time we have access to another department's data is if you're given access to it, but most of the departments, all of our stuff is segregated out. Some of the other things that we do, we manage third party. We have the smart connector. So we do have a, they call it smart connector. It's basically like an API integration that works with smart. So some organizations or some agencies and brokers that use smart, they actually just upload into smart. They actually do not actually get online and type in the data into smart. So we do maintain that connector. And we do internal support from hardware and software for everybody inside of SLTX. We do website management for smart, and we have our SLTX.org, our enterprise website that we maintain. And then we do have custom scripts that run that integrates reports from smart into our external outside enterprise website that people can pull down reports from. And then basically we do the technical user guides, we do all the renewals, and then our lovely conference room setup where we're supposed to. Like, any questions? That was like really quick.
I would point out that you talk about script. That data that goes on our website, the monthly data, is available to the public. So they have, we've had investment firms that have analyzed our data faster than we can. So they have literally sent us notes saying, hey, we found what seems to be a mistake. Can you please verify and let us know when you've corrected it? Sent us, you know, we open at 8:30 on Monday morning, and they sent me that email at 10:09. So they are really rummaging through all that data. So that piece is really integral to the industry. The industry is watching what's going on at SLTX every moment of every day. So it's amazing to think about. And a little unsettling.
If it's not out there, Craig gets it first. He's like, what's wrong? I'm like. But just to give a little background of some of the, all of our positions that we have in IT, since we have grown a lot since the last time we done this. We have a software architect. Basically, he keeps our system in order. We keeps it to where we can scale it. He does all the designs. Like, if we want to make any changes, if we're thinking about making any changes, he's the one that says, yes, we can, or no, we can't, or maybe that's not a good idea. And then I'm just like, make it work. So we have our disagreements sometimes. We do have a front-end developer we did not have before, but he focuses on all of our UI, UX interfaces. So basically what people see to make it more easier to use, to make it more user-friendly, he focuses on that, but he is also doing back-end work now. So he kind of started on one end, and now he's doing other things. We do have a lead software developer. He kind of keeps and wrangles all the software development team, keep them in line, any changes that we have. He actually kind of filters that back down. He communicates with stakeholders. He has a lot of meetings with the agents and brokers or anybody who needs help with API on the outside. Him and our business analyst handles that the majority of the time. There's Matt right there. And then we have just our regular developer, and they are the ones writing the code, testing the code, pushing the stuff out, going through the tickets that we have. And then if you go down one more, so we have a business analyst, and she is very lovely. Her name is Ariel. I don't know if you guys got to meet her, but If anybody attends any of our training, she's normally the one that's hosting the training, doing the training. She interprets the business documents. If we're having new tickets created by both internal and external users, she actually creates and writes the tickets and get them ready for our development team to work. And she acts as a bridge between both the developers and our basically our stakeholders and our internal teams. We have an IT support specialist. He makes sure that all of our hardware is working for all of our internal users. He also keeps the website updated. And then he does a lot of checking for like network issues and things like that. He also does the background checks of like our emails. If anybody has emails stuck somewhere or something like that, he also helps out with that. And then we have a UAT lead. Basically, she does and maintains all of our user acceptance testing. So as the developers are getting done with work, all the work has to be tested. She's responsible for either delegating that work out to get tested, testing the work, and then giving that feedback back to the developers if there's any work that needs to be corrected, if anything feels like quirky, or if something is just like, it's working, but maybe we need to do it in another manner. So she's our feedback person for the developers. But that is literally our whole team right now. We're hoping to add one more probably. We'll be definitely adding one
probably,
more.
Definitely. Yeah.
Sooner probably than later. We'll probably be adding, everybody does not like that term, but we'll probably be hiring an AI developer. So we got some stuff in the works. So that would be our next person that we would be bringing on.
Who's got that more depth of one?
Okay. I'm getting deaf, but yeah.
Well, yeah. Was jealous.
Huh? They are jealous.
And it was free.
Now the really fun stuff. And Shalanda said the IT stuff was important. Finance and accounting.
We have to have you. Boring or not.
So the staffing office follows government accounting standards. Yes. We were considered a special purpose government entity, defined as having a separate government body, legally separate from primary government, and financially independent. It's a component unit of the state of Texas for financial purposes, a legally separate organization for which the elected officials of the primary governments are financially accountable. The IRS, we are approved as a 501c. This is different than most TDI quasi-government organizations. Most are 501c6. We are 501c3. Accounting is completed using the accrual basis accounting, which means we report revenue or expenses are recorded when the transaction occurs rather than when payment is received. Here's a little breakdown on how we receive cash. If you notice on this, the majority of this comes through our ePay system. We do receive physical checks, but if you could look on here, the majority of the revenue from 2025 came from ACH payments. $7,537,000 came from ACH, $7,736,000 in 2024 came from ACH payments. It also breaks down the total fee structure that we're paying to ePay for ACH, $16,608 versus $15,459 in 2024. We are actually still receiving physical checks. We received 413 physical checks, totaling a $129,000 deposited into the account for 2025 and 492 checks in 2024. $175,000. One of the noticeable things is Visa cards. If you look, you see the Visa payments. We only did process 92 Visa payments, totaling we deposited $22,679. But look how much the average fee on a Visa card is charged. And I looked up the range. The range of Visa charges made is between $2,000 to $3,000, and they're paying at least $8 to $25.
Wow.
Fee. Mm-hmm. EP isn't liking us for this. And as well as, if you notice on the side of the ACH, the e-pay policy fee was $3 in 2025. In 2026, the e-pay policy fee is $3.60. So I've contacted them to try to see if we can negotiate down. So I'm having a meeting with them shortly to see what we could do. Because if you notice how our transactions went up, but the fee structure went up, but they have not changed the fee in over 8 years. So they're saying that it's time. I'm just going to still try to negotiate out the fee structure.
What are they doing for you other than, you know, that's different than just accepting ACH payments into your bank account?
Pretty much what they do, accept the ACH payments. Yeah. And
the difference is that that transaction happens their agency as well. So that's how they're getting paid. So the it streamlines agency payments. So that's what we get out of being, that's our frustration, right? It's like, well, we're not really betrothed to you. You make life easier for our customer base, but I'm not sure 20% hit without justification is worth us just swallowing. It is going to cost us more, but it's not, it's unfortunate because so many agencies, brokers use policy. It would be very disruptive for change. That's the frustration.
Got it.
We receive payments. Next one is the 26 versus 2025 budget, adopted a budget, which we did in October of last year. We had 2025 was a negative, but actually in 2026 we had a positive amount. Mainly was because of the depreciation expense and then the actual salaries had where we actually decreased some of the insurance expenses salaries.
Does travel include board members?
No. Yeah, travel and entertainment is actually the employee stuff.
Employees only.
Board expenses are in G&A.
Yes.
Yeah. So we do have, if you were to break it all out, the board expenses does have its own kind of itemized line that's budgeted, but it goes into the G&A.
Okay. That's it. Any other questions on?
And now, the funnest of the fun.
Right.
The funnest of the funnest. You will definitely not hear from me much as you do from the others, but that's how we want to keep it. If you don't hear from HR, things are running smoothly. If you do, something's happening. And so, basically, what we do is we support our employees internally with anything and everything personal related to make sure that we establish policies, we review policies together, we review compensation, and we work pretty much as a team. HR is a team of one, but it's never a team of one because we pretty much work together on everything that we do. I drive crazy with numbers on benefits and back and forth, and I try not to include anybody in negotiations because all of that is background, but we want to make sure that we focus on employees while we remain within the laws and complying with labor and employment laws, because that ultimately it is the most important part of it. Whatever we do in the HR world, we have to still comply internally with everything we do. The slide here represents three areas that I focus the most on everything that we do internally. And we support engagement for employees. We're about to do something early May as an organization. I say we, but that's Marissa. We is Marissa. She does all of the background work. The amount of work that Marissa puts in to everything that we do is
insane. So I wouldn't be able to do it without her. So I really appreciate what she does for us. So everything that you guys see, Marissa has hands on when it comes to that employee engagement. Any employee relationship situations, we work together. Typically, either a supervisor or an employee. And we'll make sure that Greg is aware of things that are happening in the organization as well. Staff alignment, we do that, and we are actually working on that. I am doing a compensation analysis, and the IT world is changing so much, even in titles. It's completely crazy, so we need to work on some internal staff alignment in the sense of titles versus the responsibilities that the employees are doing. And then I handle everything insurance related, from negotiations to implementation of everything. This year we switch our FSA program. No complaints, everybody seems to be happy with it. And so I make sure that all of these are on a yearly basis. And then we handle also the internal and external communications. On the payroll side, it's mainly the personnel side that I manage, because the actual I'm the backup of the backup for payroll. When Ming or Ronnie are not available, I am the person who jumps in. But other than that, it will be more the personnel side of it that I handle. And then the internal education and training, and of course the policies, which we change our handbook effective this year, and you guys participated in that change. That's pretty much what I do. And again, like I don't want to hear from you other than here, which is hi and how is everybody doing? But overall, we want to make sure that we focus on our people and make sure that we've had a very good couple of years of maintaining our group and making sure that the group grows, and we just want to make sure that we provide all the support that we need to provide internally so that we continue to grow. Any questions for me? That's it. That's the easy. The fun stuff's fun.
I will say that the FSA change, there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff.
Yes.
Changing an FSA pattern.
6 weeks of work.
So far. So I will take the old one was called WEX. This one's called Flex. I don't know what it is with the X's in these things, but I'll take Flex over WEX any day. So much better. So, and actually he's negotiated. A lot of the reason is easier and better is because of the things that she said, here's what I want my program to be. So it's been pretty awesome.
Also, that is not there. I do the we have to comply with the ERISA rules in our 401k and our pension plan. So I do the end of year compliance testing just to make sure that we are ERISA compliant on those two areas. Because if we fail, we lose the programs. So I make sure that we work on all of that. That all has to be done before the 5500, which I don't do. Because that's numbers, and that's the finance department.
So in your appendix, there's a couple of things that are in the appendix, and then most of it has been pulled out and put into the blue folder. So all the policies and things like that and things that you need to sign. So when you get the opportunity, please sign the documents that require a signature. Again, back to Marissa. But if not, you can acknowledge the... Send it to us. We don't have a fax machine, but you can take it.
Don't. If you can't sign them today, that would be great.
They're going to be on the left side of your...
Mm-hmm. Thank you, ma'am.
You're welcome. And all the other policies in the plan of operations go the other way.
We won't read the staff bios. We won't do that. Anybody have any questions or discussion topics?
There is an expense report in there. Yeah. So that Ronnie wanted
to. We updated the expense report with the new mileage. So you have that in your package also.
And if you need an electronic copy.
All right. Well, if there's no questions or discussion topics, I will
pass it back over to Jim to close up shop.
All right. All right. Thank you, Greg, and the whole stamping office team for an awesome job and a very informative training meeting. Thanks to all the board members for participating. There being no other business before the board's meeting is adjourned at 2:10 p.m. on the 26th of March.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.